Blog Talk Radio.
Booker T and the MGs, a little song called Summertime, which you guys heard on the last edition of Draconia Vampire Tunnel, which is a closer repairs. Tonight, you guys are actually listening to Project U Radio. I'm one half of those, Mr. Frankie Metro, and of course with me is our Project U Radio Senior VP. I'm going to call you the CEOP. How about that? Lynn Alexander. Lynn, how are you doing?
The CEOP.
CEOP, yes.
Well, hey, whatever works.
I like that.
You know, I'm pretty non-hierarchical, though, so that's, which, you know, is interesting. It's an interesting segue sort of into the topic, oddly enough, you know, authority, hierarchy. You know, one of the things that we're hoping to do, and I think that it's always very difficult when you try to bridge political movements, political topics, and, you know, literary and just art topics together, because a lot of people think that there's sort of a disconnect there, that you know, like even people will say, I'm a writer, I don't get into politics, or I'm an artist, I don't get into politics. And that always strikes me as a little bit strange. And I hope we can get into a little bit why, you know, why that might be strange, because I think that when you talk about a lot of political beliefs, you definitely get into things, you know, that we're hopefully going to get into. But, you know, as far as, you know, your use of time and labor and how much of your time goes to labor and whether or not that leaves a whole lot at the end of the day for artistic pursuit. So I think it does tie in. I don't know if you, I mean, I hope you agree that it does. I assume you do. But, you know, I think part of my interest.
I do. I think that it's really naive for people to think that politics don't affect them as a writer or as a human being. I think that's very naive, of course, because it's pretty obvious that it does. That being said, we are joined tonight by two representatives of the National Socialist Party of the United States of America, the Los Angeles local chapter. Of course, me. I'm going to have to ask him how to pronounce his last name. Stolyasik, I believe, is actually how you pronounce that. I might be wrong. And of course, I'm going to go ahead and bring you guys on. We got 310, so you guys can go ahead and actually introduce yourselves, because I'm doing a horrible job of it right now. We got 310 and 310 Live as well. And I believe we also have Marty Rife on the line. And Mimi, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. And, of course, you actually brought along with you. I'm sorry, you actually brought along another of the National Socialist Party with you as well.
Yeah, I have Lynn Lomibouts here. And we're with the Socialist Party, USA.
Okay.
Welcome. Thank you. You know, and I think, I mean, it's wonderful that you guys are taking the time, because, you know, we really do appreciate that, Frankie and myself, we do. And, you know, it's a good opportunity, hopefully, to ask you a few things, if you don't mind, also, as we, you know, get into some discussion.
Right.
Sure.
And, of course, tonight, the reason that we do have you guys on the program tonight, as well as Marty Rifles, and we'll get into that with Marty here in a little bit. The reason that we do have you guys on the program tonight is we want to examine, of course, anarchy and anarchism in the United States, of course, and all over the world. We'll think of it as a global theory. I'll go ahead and ask, I'll go ahead and pose this question to you, Mimi. Start with you. Do you think, sir, that being a representative of the Socialist Party, do you think that socialism, as theorized by Benjamin R. Tucker, is more of a labor-oriented philosophy as opposed to anarchism, which is more of a political theorized philosophy? What do you think about that?
Well, I actually think, you know, where we're coming from, I don't think the two are exclusive from one another. You know, I think they kind of work hand in hand. It's not dissimilar, I think, from what I heard the two of you speaking about before we got on the line, about maybe a writer saying that, you know, they don't really get involved in politics. It doesn't affect them. I think what you know, our approach is, you know, it's comprehensive. I think that, you know, we're sort of waging a battle on, you know, multiple fronts, which includes labor, which includes, you know, electoral politics, you know, human rights, gender equality, you know. So I think that we have to approach this programmatically, you know, like across all fronts, as opposed to just labor. You know, of course, it's a big challenge, but, you know, that's why we're here.
All right. No, I mean, I agree that it all ties in. I mean, I think, you know, I'm happy to hear you say that, because I think one of the criticisms a lot of us have is that we don't see that connection. You know, for some reason people are able to compartmentalize and they don't see that, you know, that it really is. I mean, it really is connected. It's good to hear you make that point, I think.
And I think that as Lynn and I were just talking about this earlier, you know, we need as many people as possible to engage in, you know, organizing and activism. And, you know, here in the United States, you know, it's not at this point like people are flooding the gates to organize and to sort of tackle capitalism. And I think that in our experience, you have a lot of people who might be interested in socialism, but perhaps their first exposure to socialism is with people who are sort of engaged in the theoretical debate. And as a result, they feel either intimidated or sort of self-conscious, and they kind of turn away. And what we're trying to do is to, you know, we want to bring people in and to be as inclusive as we possibly can. And because, you know, the people that we're trying to reach are working class people, you know, students. And we can't afford to be, you know, turning people away with our approach. So, you know, we're sort of here in California really trying to be conscious of creating a culture that's really welcoming. We have had friends tell us that, you know, they're interested, but they feel either intimidated or they feel that it's sort of exclusionary. And that's something that we'd like to see, at least where we're concerned, we'd like to see that stop. And not that there's not a place for theory, but we need to bring people in, you know, and really get this ball rolling, you know?
Right. No, I think that's wonderful. It's wonderful. I mean, I think that also, and I don't mean to, you know, I get excited about it when I hear that, and I guess I'm coming from also a labor organizing point of view, mm-hmm. Where a lot of those same sentiments I think have been expressed that, you know, we can't afford at this point, you know, to be alienating people. We really need to, you know, be reaching out, and so mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And I'm wondering, I mean, I know, Frankie, I don't mean to jump in with a question, but since you mentioned that, do you think there's also a little bit of, I don't want to call it a branding problem, but some misunderstandings? And do you think that there's a little bit of an issue with people really understanding the way that you guys integrate your beliefs into practical living, that it isn't just something that's in a textbook that you hear about in college on a campus? You know, how you integrate your belief systems into, you know, daily living. A lot of people say, oh, socialism or feminism or anarchism, that's, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with the real world. I mean, I hear that a lot. I imagine you do, and you have to combat that all the time.
Hi, this is Lynn. I think that is one of our central focuses, because we do realize, I mean, Mimi and I, although we are by no means, extremely learned theoreticians, what we do know is that we have read, like, the foundations of various theories. And what we've done is we've personally looked at those things, looked at those ideas, and translated them into daily life. And that's a lot of what we do when we talk to people about socialism, and we try to combat it from the very start. When we start, you know, talking to people about socialism, we don't really talk about theory. We don't really throw, you know, the word socialism around. We talk about real issues. We talk about, you know, mothers who need daycare services. We talk about students who can't afford to go to college. We talk about people going into bankruptcy because of the lack of healthcare and lack of money for healthcare. So that really is how we talk to people and how we try to combat the kind of the miseducation of socialism and I guess what you call the branding problem.
Right. Wonderful.
Yeah.
In the case of saying over there about how you've done a lot, you guys have a lot of different cities of office.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up there?
Yeah, I'm having a little trouble here.
So is that better?
I think it maybe is the Skype connection. It's a little bit skippy.
Oh, okay.
Because I didn't catch what he said. Yeah, he uses a Skype system, so I'm not sure if that's maybe the problem. Sometimes there's a little bit of a connection issue, but he might be working that. I apologize for that. As you can imagine, I have a lot of things I would love to ask you guys, but. I think one of the things, I mean, obviously, we're approaching it, you know, and like I said, not exclusively, but, you know, in this particular show, we tend to focus on writers and artists and sort of the, mm-hmm. the underground, you know, independent small press community. And, mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that really, I mean, whether you look at Marx's theory or you look at different, you know, ideas that I'm sure you guys can get into a little bit more is just this idea that people don't realize how much of their lives and their hours in their day are spent really involved in labor, and how much of it yeah. is given to the profit and the disproportionate profit of other people's benefit and not really their own, and how much it robs them of that time
yeah.
that they could be pursuing, you know, things like writing and things that make them have more fuller lives,
happy.
Time with their families,
yeah.
time. That's mm-hmm. that's what really touches me, I think, the most as far as, you know, my reading and what grabs out at me is the time, because, you
yeah.
know, the precious nature of it, and that it's a commodity that we just so easily give up. You know, and I don't know that we question what we get back as a society, as laborers,
mm-hmm.
as workers, when we do
mm-hmm.
that. So, you know, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure you guys are, you know, that sort of, you know, touches in, you know, you guys as well, that there's so many people out there that are working two or three jobs. I mean, there's no time at the end of the day, you know, to be creative, let alone sleep.
I'm glad you brought that up, Lynn. That's an excellent segue to my next question for you guys, and I'll try to make this really brief. I wanted to talk a little bit about labor theory of value, that being, of course, the value of a commodity's relation to the labor needed to produce and obtain that commodity. I wanted to actually, I guess I could pose this to either one of you guys. Do you guys think it truly, like, does this eliminate the idea of, like, profits or profit sharing or profit margins? And actually, I was going to ask, how do you aptly, you know, regulate such a policy in a socialism environment that governs themselves or what have you?
Right, right. Well, you know, I think the idea and something that, you know, we propose and that we support, you know, things like worker-owned cooperatives and you know, the worker control over of course, you know, means of production and distribution and that sort of thing. I think me personally, you mentioned, like, would this eliminate the concept of profit? Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I was asking if that eliminated the idea of profit. So,
I think, it's kind of a heavy question. I think we, you know, approach this that, you know, we can all look at what we'd like to see as sort of, and of course it's not really a one size fits all, but, you know. What is a comfortable life? You know, well, I think a comfortable life is your basic needs are met, your health care, you know, your housing, your education. And, you know, we're not proposing this really tight-belted, fiscal austerity. I mean, you know, we want people to you know, enjoy their lives and to be able to, you know, engage in things that make them happy and to have fun and to have a good time. I think it's just, in a capitalist system, that just spirals so far out of control. We say often, like, you know, you hear, you know, people making $20, $30, $50 million a year. Does that mean that person couldn't, you know, live a quality life and a happy life making, you know, $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year? I don't think so. And I think, you know, if somebody has a problem enjoying their life making, you know, $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year, my feeling is, you know, that person's an asshole. So, you know, I think, you know, some profit so you can enjoy your life and, you know, if you have children to be able to, provide your children with things that they might enjoy. Now, that's great. That's cool. It's just, you know, profit in a capitalist system, it comes far too often at the expense of everyone else, you know, and it's got to stop.
Yeah. And the environment, I would add, too. I mean, you know, definitely at the expense of the environment, I think we don't always mm-hmm. consider, and we should consider, because I think that's, you know, something that, you know, we see the results of that right now, over consumption. It's not a sustainable path. I mean, you know, and a lot of people will say this, capitalism, the way that it appears to us now, is not a sustainable path, because it's about just growth and growth and more and more. And, mm-hmm. you know, our resources are, we only have so much that we can strip. But, you know, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because, you know, actually one criticism that a lot of people say of this point of view is, well, the problem gets into what constitutes, you know, an adequate standard of living. Is an adequate standard of living, you know, under what you guys are saying, or under, you know, a socialist or a Marxist kind of, you know, mindset? If you translate that into standard of living, a lot of people say, yeah, but you know what? What I consider to be basic needs being met is very different than the next person, and how do you address that? I mean, like you said, could you live very well on $100,000 a year? Well, I sure could. You know, I sure could do just fine. But someone else would say, "Oh my gosh, that's poverty." You know, it's so relative. Wealth is so relative. You know, that we've really lost sight, I think, of what, you know, a standard of living and what decent living and getting your needs met are, with confusing needs and wants. And, you know, it's hard to say, but I know that's a criticism, that it's, you know, sort of like, how do you look out for getting basic needs met in this kind of a system when you can't even define what that is anymore?
Right on.
I don't know how you guys deal
I'm actually
going
to use this opportunity to bring in our other guest, Mr. Marty Rifles, who is unmuted, and I wanted to pose this question to you, Marty.
Sure.
I was going to ask you, since we are talking about labor theory, value, and what have you, do you think that policies such as this, do you think that they ultimately contradict what is known as the individualistic philosophy of anarchy?
First of all, can you hear me all right? Because I haven't really said anything.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, perfectly.
Okay. Great.
You're perfect.
So I guess I'll just jump into where we were at there. Yeah, no. The thing about anarchism, I mean, there are different strains of anarchism, just as there are different strains mm-hmm. of socialism or communism. This is just a typical thing. Politics is a very divided playground here. But as an anarchist, I consider myself a socialist as well as a communist. I draw on anything that's going to make the world a better place. And I think that if we aren't broad-minded enough to integrate lessons and ideas from different ideologies and points of view, then we're really not grasping either the importance of our work or the bigger picture of what our work implies.
Absolutely.
But Yeah, indeed. The thing about the labor theory of value, I just wanted to touch on it really quickly. I want to simplify it a little bit. I don't think that that profit and surplus value, which is what in the equation of the labor theory of value is basically exploited labor, they aren't synonyms. And a lot of people make that mistake in classical economics, in analysis of Marxist economics, because that's in their terms, profit is always, it's just profit. It doesn't matter where it comes from. But Marxism makes a distinction. Or, you know, I mean, lots of socialists have also upheld. I don't mean to just put all Marxists. But basically, as long as it's not coming at the expense of someone else's time for which they are not compensated, profit's cool. I mean, I think that most of us would agree if you spend your time on a chair, you got the wood together, then you worked on the chair, well, you can sell it at a higher price now, and that profit's totally cool. You put all the work into it. That's reasonable. You know, and I don't think anyone's going to want to argue with you or try to set up a state bureau to organize the price of handmade chairs so that, you know, at least I hope that's not what kind of socialism we're talking about here, because I'm in the wrong room. but no, I guess to your question, I mean, do I think that labor theory of value contradicts anarchism? No, I would say that if people spent time, and I think that it's a really sad thing that I'm not enough socialists spend time with anarchists, and not enough anarchists spend time around communists, so that there's a lot of myths built up between each community as barriers that, you know, I talk to a lot of anarchists, and I used to be in the Communist Party. I'm still technically a member, but I don't, well, whatever, you know. The thing is that if you don't have that crosstalk, there's like a certain level of dialogue that's necessary to understand what the other side's saying. If you really look at anarchist literature, the majority of it is collectivist in nature. They promote organizing. You know, they're not all out going to punk shows and breaking stuff. Although some of them are, and some of us, I should say us, because I used to organize punk shows, so I'm not innocent. But you know, I mean, anarchists are there's different kinds of anarchists, and very few of them. Anyone who's really involved with the anarchist movement as a whole is also for organizing and for collective work and for socialism. They just mean a little less state in when they refer to socialism. You know, like the kinds of questions you guys were talking about, like about, say, what constitutes a reasonable salary in a capitalist society. Well, if you think about it, and if you look at the facts, I mean, they've actually done a study. I don't really know the numbers off the top of my head, but they said that after something like $80,000 a year, the net amount of happiness found among people making those sums levels off. So that you can make more than $80,000, but anything above that, you're going to be the same amount of miserable or happy that you were when you reached that point. And it makes sense if you look at these millionaires who will risk their entire family, their lives, their careers on, and they're already millionaires. They already have $50 million in like 18 yachts for no reason, and they're going to gamble it all for no reason on something else that makes no sense because they have an addiction, and that addiction is money. It's a greed sickness, and they believe falsely that being richer means being better, being happier. And I feel as if all the fairy tales we were taught as kids should have taught us by now that money doesn't equal happiness. And even more sadly, at the expense of other people is where this richness comes from. You know, and people are spending too much of their life working for a living, and not enough of their life is actually spent on living. And that's a human travesty. And it's amazing that we can live in such an era of technological advancement, information technology, knowledge is everywhere. It's hard not to be educated. You really have to avoid knowledge, honestly, in this day and age. That's my personal opinion. You really have to be avoiding knowledge. And I mean, I talk to people in bars and sports events and just where I go all over the place just to do whatever. And I'll talk to people about politics because it's fun. And everyone will tell me they just avoid it. Like they'll turn on the news comes on, they hear about what's going on with whatever, they change the channel. They don't want to hear about Occupy Wall Street. They don't want to hear about it because they don't have any hope. They lack a fundamental belief that things can get better. And that's a scary way to see the world because I've never experienced it myself. I've had my moments of doubt, sure, but I've always been politically active since I was 15 years old. So, I mean, I've always believed the world can change. And it's heartbreaking to me that people have given up hope. But I don't think that the general despair in society should be any cause for us to give up hope because at the end of the day, I think Occupy and other movements is proving that interest is sparking again, that people are becoming more interested in making fundamental social change, and that it's really just a matter of time and patience for us. But and we have to find the best tactics, and that's why I don't really get into this game of anarchism versus socialism versus communism.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really, realistically, even libertarians have their role to play in the overall change the society is making. That's my opinion. I know a lot of people find that contentious, but I think that, you know, I think everybody's got their spot. You know what I mean? And when the situation gets down to it, we're not in that privilege of making calls like, oh, well, I'm not going to work with that whole section of people. You know what I mean? I'm not going to work with this entire group. That's ridiculous. People are starving. 40,000 kids starve to death every day in the third world while America is throwing away excess food in order to balance world prices, which is a phrase that makes me sick to my stomach. But that number was only 10,000 when I first joined the Young Communist League. Okay, now it's 40,000. That scares me. And if we aren't actively pursuing alliances across the board, education across the board, we need to be teaching everybody. And I mean, I don't mean like in a theoretical way, because as was discussed, I don't think it's so much that people are intimidated by theory as much as it's kind of it wastes a lot of people's time trying to think about high-minded explanations when most people already know the common sense truth right in front of their faces. And I think that's probably more of a way to get people engaged in anything else. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm rambling. I've been talking for a while.
Oh, no. No, man, it's you bring up some excellent points there. And what I wanted to touch on there, because you did a little bit, is the cooperation between different sects of ideologies like socialism and anarchy and communism and what have you. What do you guys think? I actually posed this to Lynn Lomabau. I actually wanted to ask you, what do you think the separation was in sort of the demonstrations that we've seen across the country in places like Greece and Spain like that? What do you think the reason is for the separation between those different sects? I know that there was a lot of tension in Greece recently between some of the anarchists, some of the Black Bloc anarchists, and some of the nationalists. What do you think the separation is between the two?
I feel like such a dunce for. I don't think I can answer that question. But I'm sorry, I'm not purposely trying to redirect. But Mimi might be able to answer that question better. But I can tell you that here, the Socialist Party in California, particularly in LA, we work all the time with local anarchists. The Young Communist Party, we're really good friends with them. We actually held an event at their location, and we're in constant contact with them. We go to each other's meetings. We keep each other, you know, abreast of all our activities, and there's a lot of crossover and just general agreement on what I think his name was Max, you know, common sense agreement on what we're striving for.
This is Mimi. I think this is really important. I think as like here in Southern California, like as we organize and as young people start to get interested and involved in, you know, the not just the socialist movement, but sort of a movement to radically change the system, they don't really see and perhaps even understand the necessity of these, like, historical divisions. And to us, I think that's a really good thing, you know, because, you know, we need to work together. We're not operating from, you know, a position inside the victory circle, you know. This challenge is you know, it's insane. And, you know, we need as much solidarity as we can possibly muster. And, you know, I think the hope is that where divisions and, you know, sectarianism has traditionally existed, that we can start to see some of those lines of demarcation erode. And we want to be part of that, you know. As Lynn mentioned, here in, you know, in Southern California, we hosted Bobby Seale, and we did that at the, you know, with the Young Communists at their location. We work often with the Peace and Freedom Party here in California. We have party members who are Greens. You know, we have party members who are anarchists. And, you know, I think we're all sort of fighting a lot of common goals. And, you know, that sectarianism, those divisions between socialists, anarchists, et cetera, you know, I know this sounds really simplistic, but we're just not into it.
That's good to hear.
And I think, you know, what we're seeing a lot of, particularly in LA, is that even people who aren't aligning themselves with specific political ideologies, they're definitely open and interested and on our side when we talk about issues in terms of everyday life and the sort of programs and ideas that we have to resolve those ideas or those problems. That the youth that I've been in touch with, they are totally on board and supportive, but I think what Mimi's talking about, that they don't see these divisions, I think it's also manifesting in kind of like this, like just a general shift towards collectivism and the idea of, you know, improving society and working on behalf of humans, you know, creating a more humanist society.
Right on. Hell yeah. Lynn Alexander.
Yes.
Lynn? Yes. What did you think, Lynn? What is your opinion?
Well, you know what, first of all, and I can't say this enough, I mean, it really, like I said, it makes me very happy to hear you mention so many times the not only the crossover and the collaboration between different groups, because I think so many times we've gotten accustomed to people sort of dividing themselves into their own camps, you know, well, I'm an anarcho-feminist, well, I'm this kind of feminist, well,
yeah.
I'm this kind of anarchist, well, I'm a, you know, I'm this type of socialist, and we're, you know, we're more inclusive than you are. And, you know, we consider
mm-hmm.
this and you prioritize that. And it gets so divisive and difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, through all of that to really, you know, realize that, you know what, hey, we really have many more opportunities to reach out to one another. You know, even
mm-hmm.
if you don't necessarily, you know, agree on every single point. You know, obviously
mm-hmm.
you don't have to work together. And I think it's okay to say, you know what, we can agree that there are a few places where, you know, things are more important to you or to me, but we're in this together, and we really have to start thinking that way and see that it really does take that effort. So I'm glad that you mentioned that. But I'm also glad, and like I said earlier, to hear you mention that step away from it being, you know, theory and jargon and textbook and things
mm-hmm.
that, like I said, you read about on a campus, where people really feel disconnected from that and removed from that. I think what a lot of people really want to know, at least from my experience, is, okay, but how does this work in life? How does this apply to me? What does this look like? What on earth does an anarchist see the world as looking like? And when you
mm-hmm.
start getting into, you know, well, you know, maybe, you know, like you mentioned, daycare, maybe health care, maybe,
mm-hmm.
you know, human rights, getting basic needs met, you know, things like that, solving problems and really, you know, coming up with solutions that aren't necessarily, you know, have a political bumper sticker involved. I think it's seeing past that and saying, you know what, there are human needs here that we all can work together to fill. It just, you know, like I said, I'm really happy to hear, you know, those two things in particular from you guys, because I think that's just so essential moving forward, that we, you know, the collaboration and the application of ideas and beliefs, you know, getting them off the T-shirts and getting them into real life, you know,
mm-hmm.
and, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think, and how it really affects you, you know.
And then I think, you know, I'm sorry to interrupt real quick, but like our office is downtown in Los Angeles, you know, and we talk about this a lot. It's in the middle of a working class community, and you know, if we hit the streets there and we approach the neighborhood with, you know, if our first contact with them is on a, you know, sort of this highbrow theoretical basis, or, you know, we're approaching them with labels and things like that, one, it's confusing as hell, and two, they're probably going to say, you know, get the hell out of my face, you know, I have a family to feed, you know. You have, right. You know, you're not speaking to me, you're speaking at me. And, you know, I think, again, there's so much to do that getting caught up in you know, the sectarianism and all this bullshit, it's beyond counterproductive. It's sad, you know. I remember, I think at one time Bobby Seale had said something when they were coming up with the 10-point platform and program with the Black Panther Party, you know, they wanted to reach people who, you know, they're worried about putting food on the table, you know. They're worried about paying their rent, you know. And we got to reach working class people, you know. And I think we have to speak as the people that we are. We're humans, you know. We're going through the same problems and same, you know, difficulties that everybody is. Let's approach them like, you know, we're on the same planet, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right, just to bring in, sorry, Marty here, but I wanted to mention, because you mentioned Greece, and that's a really, that's a fascinating study of where division can arise from, conditions that might merit it. And I don't necessarily want to completely dog on the parties over there, but basically what happened in Greece and what's happening still in Greece and is spreading to other European countries in the midst of the debt crisis is that you have a lot of anarchists in Greece. They have a very long tradition in that country, and they've organized such that basically they have more or less violent confrontations with the police on a semi-regular basis, to speak lightly of it.
Yeah.
And initially, of course, you had the communist and socialist parties kind of weighing the direction of supporting the uprising in some respects. And then, of course, a big protest movement emerged among basically average sections of Greek population, you know, which would be the left of center majority, you know, in a lot of ways in that country. And then there was a decisive split when the organizations that basically run for office, and that's really where a lot of anarchists start drawing the line when it comes to organizing with the parties, because a lot of them either support the Democrats in the Communist Party's case or field their own candidates in elections, which is seen as sort of a retreat from revolutionary organizing and an entering into a parliamentary struggle, which does take up a lot of time, resources, and energy to conduct realistically. Whether we want to admit it or not, it's hard to do other stuff when you're focusing on an electoral campaign. I've seen it happen with all the organizations. I worked with the Green Party in Philly, and their entire budget was sucked up by all the fees and all of the applications and all the stuff you had to do. And honestly, I could see the tens of thousands of dollars I honestly spent going to much more productive uses. I was very sad to see that much energy and time spent on that kind of project, which ultimately, of course, resulted in what you would expect, and that's the loss of the candidate because the media wouldn't give them interviews, you know, because they're never going to. The system is not structured for you to make an entry into parliamentary politics. We have a country of 300 million people and a very, very tiny Congress full of people who are bought and paid for. It costs more than $1 billion now to be president. I forget how many millions per congressperson on average it takes per campaign. So, I mean, realistically, you know. But anyway, the point is that these people would, the Communist Party and the other parties in Greece began to feel as if the radicalism was too much. Now, I am a big proponent of diversity of tactics. That, you know, if you are engaging in a political struggle, sure, you may not want to associate yourself with elements doing that if you're trying to maintain your legal status as a party. But the challenge is how do you balance that thin line of we are an organization dedicated to changing society on the most fundamental level, and then also trying to validate that organization with the very government and socioeconomic and political system that one claims to oppose. Because I do think at some point, and that point comes a lot sooner than it seems a lot of people in these organizations tend to think, you're forced to choose which one you're going to do. Are you for a revolutionary social change, or are you for a parliamentary peaceful organization? And we've seen that a lot of the groups that thought they could balance that line, either they morphed and they became basically social democratic, you know, not at all revolutionary parties, like the Italian Communist Party. They're a parliamentary organization, or they floundered in the face of extreme threats, such as in the German Communist Party's case, when because they couldn't figure out what they wanted to do, Hitler won, and then he had all of them sent to concentration camps. And honestly, and I'm not a doomsayer about America, but I certainly think that we will enter a time. We've already got warrantless wiretapping, the Patriot Act, a lot of scary laws that are being passed every day that everyone agrees are wrong, but nobody seems to actually – the media certainly stays away from it. There's no criticism of government censorship, of government propaganda being pumped into our schools, whatever schools are left anyway. They're closing, I think, 50 public schools in Philadelphia and privatizing half of them. But anyway, you know, we're in a very scary time in lead up to something that doesn't look good. And I don't know if I necessarily want to be on a list of people associated in an organization that's trying to balance that line, you know, and I'm full of support, you know.
That's a great point. I was actually going to ask you, Marty, do you think, I was going to ask you, like, where do you think that the blame for America's lack of the same level of impactful demonstrations like in Greece and Spain and what have you, do you think that the lack of impact that those kind of demonstrations that we've had in places like Seattle and what have you on the whole social spectrum, do you think that that lies within the idea that, there's some critics out there that say, group-oriented uprisings or group-oriented demonstrations are more detrimental to the message because of divided attention, focus, and expression, as opposed to coordinated singular displays of protest?
Well, I think if you're really dealing with the protest situation, or even more ambitiously with the revolutionary situation, you're not going to have the kind of coordination that everybody wishes, you know, it would be possible.
Right.
You're going to have fringe elements, and if they come out in numbers, we have to figure out how to integrate them, or at least find a way to make that to make the one side that has its singular message distinct, but not opposed to the work that's being done by others, regardless of how much we may agree or disagree with their tactics. I feel like that's a very important point to stress, because no matter how much you wish or talk about it, the odds of convincing anarchists not to be anarchists, you know, they're pretty bad. I'm just, you know, from an insider perspective. But I wanted to address your point specifically, because I was once approached by a Greek anarchist who said, you know, what's wrong with America? You guys all speak the same language. Europe, we speak like 30, 40 different languages, but we're still able to organize.
Oh, I'm sorry, you broke up there.
My response to that was that realistically, I think that part of the problem is geographical. Because all of America's urban centers, except for the certain spots, like, you know, I think San Francisco and Los Angeles are relatively close together, but, you know, somehow it doesn't. Oakland,
do
LA, San Fran, I don't know what's going on there. But then the Eastern Corridor from Boston all the way down to D.C. But the thing is that people seem to be very, very isolated in a lot of ways. And I don't know if it is geographical. That's merely my theory. I wish I had a better one, because it's not, in my opinion, it's not satisfactory. But I think that maybe it might have more to do with America's centrality in the imperialist context. You know, you have a very gigantic military, a very large police apparatus, and everybody knows it. Everybody knows that this is a fortress. And even many people who would like to see it change are still very much under the illusion that the military itself, not just the troops, the individual troops being a different thing, but the military itself is somehow symbolically connected to them as a representation of their own national defense, which is, of course, a very scary illusion to believe that the army in the United States is being used for national defense. I don't know where they get that impression, but apparently some people believe that. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe, is it pervasive propaganda? Is it geographical? Spatial problems with interconnectivity and people traveling for protests like they would maybe in Europe more easily? Is it a question of historical consciousness? Honestly, there may be multiple variables that are interplaying at a different, you know, that are working together and kind of coming together in a very difficult way for us in America. But I would like to think that regardless of that, it will be possible with enough education and organizing to break through whatever it is we're dealing with. I wish I had a more substantive response.
No, it's an excellent response. Wow. Mimi or Lynn, did either one of you guys want to touch in on that?
I think that Mark said there are probably, multiple variables that contribute to, I don't want to say this condition, but, I think one, mass media plays a huge role. I think people are, and I don't necessarily place the full blame on folks for this, but people are pretty well pacified, and until things I think have sort of a direct impact on them personally, they're pacified, they're scared. I think somebody mentioned before they feel hopeless. Also, when they look to any form of leadership to help guide them in sort of a productive direction, generally that leadership is guiding them, in the wrong direction. So I think you tie all these things together, and, the idea that people are sort of going to, I guess, in the United States, organically, organize toward a radical change, it's probably not going to happen. But I do think that as individuals take, even if it's a small step forward, it does have an impact. I think actually the Black Panther Party is a great example, you have a few people who took a small step forward and, it started to spread and, you saw some real progress, whether it's at the free breakfast program or, that was a real threat to this system, So I think that, the folks who are sort of involved in organizing maybe may need to sort of take a personal accountability to, continue to take those steps forward, but also to work on the messaging to help inspire others to take a similar step, to just take one step forward, And I think then we might start to see the results that we all kind of hope for.
I love it. I just wanted to say that we do have 7 minutes left of live streaming, of course. So if you guys did have any other questions or anything like that, listeners out there, please feel free to call in. Number is 805-856-2808. Man, it's been a really good show. I'm glad you guys actually showed up, and I did want to take the opportunity to thank each and every one of you. And Lynn, Alexander, what do you think? I think maybe like a closing statement and then maybe call it a night and save this for part two, actually?
We do tend to have topics that deal with, literary issues, artistic issues, and I do feel that it's connected. I do feel that we need to understand the connection, because I think part of the issue, whether we're talking about protests or why people don't read or why people don't get involved, I think part of it, a small part of it, but definitely part of it, is that people are too busy, I think, getting their needs met with working, with survival, And I don't know that we have the leisure time and the ability, I don't want to call it leisure, but the quality of life that really gives us the opportunity to take that step back and look at what's going on and process what's happening and learn about our world and teach our children about our world and consider the resources and consider, you know, relationships between one another, because I think we are in such a mode, especially in the United States, of trying to just, you know, pay that mortgage and get these things that we feel we need in our lives taken care of, that I don't know that it leaves a whole lot of room. A lot of people say, you know what, protesting is a luxury that you have, like when you're in college and you're, you know, you have free time on your hands, you know. And the same thing with a lot of these different isms, whichever ism, you know, you want to talk about. I think people look at it as a luxury, and the same thing with anything cultural, with anything with reading, with writing, with, it's all connected to time and to the use and exchange, I think, of your time for, you know, for what? For the profit of somebody else, for the benefit of somebody else, for them to make that extra $50 million. You know, I think that part of what concerns me is that I don't know how we can reclaim some of our time and our resources back and our planet back, because a lot of us have kids, and that's what scares me. You know, when I see people saying, what's the point of protesting, or I don't have time to get involved in politics, you know, that's, I find that to be very, very disheartening. So I, you know, that's, you know, that's, if I could sum it up with something positive, I don't know that I can, other than to say that there are people like you guys and like people that we do run across that do make me say, you know what, thank goodness there are people out there that are trying to change the perception of hope and get us to see, hey, look, we can do practical things in our communities. We can do small steps. You know, we don't have to maybe have a giant revolution tomorrow. Maybe we can do some basic things and get some things going. And that does make me very hopeful. You guys make me very hopeful, honestly. You know.
Thank you.
Oh, shucks.
Marty Rifles, did you want to impart one last nugget of wisdom upon us before we close out tonight?
Well, I guess I'll follow up with your statements there, because it is important to end on a positive note, I think the fact that we're even having this conversation, you know, on now it's June 1st, 2012, and it's on the East Coast. I don't know whatever time it is over there. But we're living in a very interesting time, and frankly, the amount of people that have been getting involved in activism and protest despite difficulties of living in this country, despite the constraints on our time, the busyness of our work schedules, a lot of people have kind of given up on all that stuff and said, fuck it, I'm going to go hang out at Occupy, you know, for the next couple of weeks and live in a tent, because that's more useful spending my time doing that than working for nothing, for peanuts, and wasting all of my time. You know, so there's a certain point we're at that people's consciousness is increasing. And I think that across the board, regardless of the ideologies, because really ideology it's just a reflection of conditions. It's not the defining, you know, like, you know, all those people at Occupy are, you know, contemplating which ism they want to adopt. No. Most people don't care about that, and they don't necessarily have to for society to become better or to become involved in, say, a library, free library project, or because, you know, they're closing the libraries too. Just so you know, it's the next thing on the slate. Yeah. But we need books. We need food. We need places for people to be able to sleep. And if we can find alternative ways of providing those necessities of life and creating a community in which you can live and be free, at least freer than you normally are, freeing your mind at least, that I think that will resonate with people and resonate with their children and resonate with their families and resonate with their loved ones in ways that giving them a pamphlet or a book to read necessarily won't. And that's good. That we're living in times where that's possible, it's a reason to be excited. I'm very excited.
Fuck yeah. All right. Lynn Lamaval, one last message from you.
Jeez. I just want to say that, you know, I know that Lynn talked about that the show focuses a lot on, you know, writing and the arts, and everything that you said, Lynn, really resonated with me because ever since I was 10, I wanted to be a literary writer, and I found myself, pretty able to support myself, to pay my rent, to buy food, transportation. But the dream of being able to do something to create a society and a life in which I could pursue those dreams and that other people could pursue the things that they really that really make them feel alive and fulfilled is worth striving for. And I think that it's a really important and compelling point, I think, to kind of communicate to people when, we are trying to motivate them into action. And like Marty said, I'm really excited. We're really excited in L.A. The National Party's excited. We're growing and collaborating. And I think we're on the right path. And we're going to keep going. And, despite all of the responsibilities that we have and try to create a model for other people, an example for other people to show them how it can be done.
Yeah.
Right on. Yeah. Well, I definitely I did want to say that we are in the archives. I wanted to take the opportunity one more time to thank each and every one of my guests. Of course, Mimi, Lynn Lamabel, and, of course, Mr. Marty Rifles. Really appreciate you guys coming through and shedding some light on some of these situations and some of the I hope that at the end of the show, I hope that people have a little bit understanding of the ideologies. And no matter what ideology you choose, I think that it's very important that you have a full, authentic understanding of what you believe in. And hopefully we accomplish some of that, shedding some light on that this week. If not,
that's
of course,
wonderful.
We will be back. Yeah. I was going to say, if we didn't do it this week, you know what? We like to do things here two times at the Project G Radio. sometimes we do. So we like to do it two times, three times, and what have you. And we'll drill it into your head until you get it. So next week will be part two of the discussion on anarchism, socialism, communism, all those isms. And, of course, you, the listeners out there, and what you consider freedom. I will leave you guys with one last question of the night to actually probably be a lead-in of next week, where we'll be focusing more on anarchist literature, how to get that out of literature and get it into action, of course. I think we touched on that a little bit tonight. And, of course, also we wanted to talk about the policies of all these isms that we're talking about tonight and how many of these policies are up to date? How many are translatable in today's market as opposed to, 200 years ago or what have you? We'll be talking about that, but I did want to leave you guys with one last question of the evening, and then we'll go ahead and close out. Does that eliminate one of the bases of society, that being the foundation that is the employer employee relationship? You guys think about that. We'll be back with that next week. Same time, same channel, I guess. Yeah. Bye.